Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Panel in the studio, and today we're going to be talking to a very important person in the current sort of state of the climate and our understanding of climate change, and that is, her name is Judith Lean. She's a researcher at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., and in particular, she's in a division called the Space Science Division. And she's been studying radiance from the sun. I think everybody listening to the program knows that life on Earth needs energy, and we get our energy predominantly from the sun. But we don't know quite how much we get and what wavelengths it is, what type of energy we're receiving. And this is what Judith does. And for her work, she's received many honors, but I guess the most important, she's a member of the National Academy of Science, and that's as high as you can get in terms of recognition for a scientist. So, Judith, after all that, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Jolly good. So, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Let's, before we get on to the radiance from the sun, which is a quite complex area, so you're going to have to be very careful. Assume you're talking to your grandmother or something like that. Where did you get your interest in science from? Where did you start?
That's always such a difficult question because people expect you to say, oh, I was so excited by science when I was young that I couldn't think of anything else to do, and that's actually not true. I found that I really enjoyed doing math problems in school, but the best part was I could actually do them faster than the boys, so it was actually quite satisfying to be able to beat the boys at something. So I got interested in doing maths and physics, and my parents always stressed that if you can do maths and physics, then you can do anything. So,
hang on a minute, though. So your parents must have known something about math and physics. So they were into that game before you came along?
Well, my father was an engineer, and my mother was a secretary, but she knew because she didn't have a college education. She knew that you had to have, like she would say, get the degree paper, then you can find a job that you like.
Ah, very, very good. And so math and physics, and I tend to, that's my background too. I didn't want to do what I do, but the school teachers and my parents forced me into math, physics, and chemistry. All right?
Well, you're lucky. They're great things to study. I don't know about the chemistry. I wasn't very good at chemistry.
Now, where did all this take place? Obviously in Australia somewhere.
It took place in Australia in a mining town called Broken Hill, which is located 700 miles west of Sydney. So basically you get on a train in Sydney and you go for 2 days, and then you come to this mining town. And the thing that was actually great about it is that because it was so far out in the desert, the New South Wales, which is the state that Broken Hill is in, the New South Wales Department of Education sent out to Broken Hill all these young teachers that it thought were a bit of a nuisance, but they were great teachers, really young, really energetic. So it was actually a fabulous place to be schooled.
I love the idea. All the rambunctious, irreverent teachers go
exactly
out there.
Exactly, I know, and they would go down to the pub every afternoon, right, and they would teach us how to play basketball. And
hey, we learn a lot of things just from that little introduction. And I've got to say, the other thing we learn, of course, is that you must have inherited the concept of railways from Great Britain, because 700 miles in 2 days in Japan, that would take about three and a half hours.
Right, we did, of course, yes.
Okay, so you went
lovely old sleeper trains. Very beautiful.
Anyway, let's go continue on. After you got this wonderful education from recalcitrant teachers, where did you study after that?
Well, after I studied at the Broken High School and graduated with what's called the high school certificate, that's the entrance to university, I then went to the Australian National University. And so you were asking me, oh, why did you choose to go there? Well, the reason I chose to go there was nothing, again, to do with science. It was because the Australian National University at the time, which was 1970, was a new university in Australia, and it was trying to recruit students from all around the country. So it said it canvassed literally all of the states in Australia and offered the students with the highest marks guaranteed entry into university. So I knew that I could go there independent of how I did in the exams. But I did well in the exams, but I went there.
Yeah, well, that's good. I I did a couple of times. I've been on lecture tours in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And I've always spent, in fact, I spent about a week and a half at Canberra at the ANU.
Oh, it's lovely, but, isn't it? Yeah, I lived in Bruce Hall.
Oh, well, very nice. But what I was going to say is that then when you go from there to other institutions, you learn the actual jealousy that the other institutions had when it was last time I was there, because ANU gets a lot of money and the others don't get quite as much.
I have to say, I was at the point when I went to ANU, I was so young, those things went right over
my head. Absolutely. Okay, so you
really was a great place. The Australian education system, probably something else we've inherited from the UK, is really excellent.
And reasonable. You don't have to go out and get loans too much. Anyway.
Well, in my day, that was when the Prime Minister was Gough Whitlam, who was a Labor Prime Minister. Education was free.
Right.
You could get a scholarship, which I did, because otherwise my parents wouldn't have been able to afford to send four daughters to college because it would have been too expensive. So I'm very, very much a beneficiary of the Australian education system.
We've got to get on to science, but I can't resist. Your three sisters, did they all go into mathematics and science and things of that nature?
Oh, no, they didn't. One of them actually does have a PhD in cancer medicine. Another one's a teacher, and the other one is a social worker.
And did the teacher go back to Broken Hill?
No. Remember, my mother wanted to get us all out of, I think, no, I told you that before right. We were recording. Her goal was to get all her daughters out of Broken Hill. And she succeeded.
Okay, well done. Now, at ANU, you took degrees in physics or math?
The first year I took physics, chemistry, pure maths, and applied maths.
That's so familiar.
Did you do that too?
Well, yeah. That's what I had in the equivalent of high school, grammar school. University,
right.
I didn't have all the math. So, when did you get interested in really what you're in now? And that's radiance from the sun.
Where did you
study that?
Okay, happened is the University of Adelaide, which is where I went to do my PhD after graduating with honours from the Australian National University, the University of Adelaide is near a rocket range called Woomera. And actually, it's where the British used to launch rockets called Skylarks. And you remember them?
I don't, actually. Yeah. It's a lovely name.
Skylarks, yeah.
A nice, innocent, well-sounding name for a lethal weapon.
But then the Americans they came to Australia and they liked to launch Araby rockets. And so one of the deals that the University of Adelaide made with NASA was, we will let you launch, or, you know, we will support your launching of, I think there were 10 or 12 Araby rockets from Woomera, and in return, NASA gave the University of Adelaide a rocket. And so for my PhD, I built instruments to go on the rocket. And the whole point of this was you put an instrument on a rocket and it looks at the sun. Then you fire the rocket up into the atmosphere. And depending on the amount of gas between the sun and you, in other words, in the atmosphere, then you can, as the rocket changes in altitude, you can actually get a profile measurement of the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. But the sun is the light source. And so I use the sun as this constant light source to do these experiments for my PhD thesis. And then after I met some Americans, of course, and I was like, oh, my God, I want to go. I live in America. I love America. It's so exciting, so much going on. And so a job came up in Boulder, Colorado, to study the sun. And I thought, well, what is there to study about the sun? Isn't it, like, constant?
Uh-huh.
Well, no. So I went from being interested in the sun as a tool to do measurements about the atmosphere, and in fact about the ozone layer as well, to working on understanding how the sun varies. And the two actually tie together really well, because variations in the sun affect the ozone layer, and variations in the sun really affect the density in the upper atmosphere in the region where, say, satellites orbit, which is maybe about 500 kilometres.
Well, what happens up there? That's a long way away from too much atmosphere, though.
Well, it's not really. I mean, okay, so the space station orbits, I think it's around 400 or so kilometres. There's a lot of stuff in space. I think there's something like over 10,000, 20,000 objects. you know.
Well, most of them we've sent up there,
most,
right?
Yeah, a lot of them are junk.
Right.
But there's a lot going on in space. And in fact, people ask me, so why are you working for the Naval Research Lab? You know, what does the Navy care about space? Isn't it ships and ocean? Well, the thing is, the Navy's actually one of the biggest users of space because you have to, all those ships have to communicate.
Right.
And they do that by satellites. And there's a whole variety of things that we use satellites for. One of the things, of course, is to measure the sun.
Well,
and also to measure the Earth, to monitor the Earth.
Right. I remember many years ago I did a radio show from a observatory, a telescope that's made out of mercury. So it was liquid.
Right? Oh, my goodness.
So this was the mirror. It was a big
parabolic
polystyrene with about 5 litres. Looking vertically upwards, of course, it couldn't tilt.
Uh-huh.
But all it was looking for, it was an Air Force operation, was looking for satellites just to make sure. When they put one up,
right,
they put it somewhere where there wasn't too much else.
Right. Well, but, in fact, there's a thing called the fence, the radar fence, that actually does track every day the satellites going over.
Well, one thing I remember from that program was there was one satellite that we saw going in the opposite direction to all the others.
Oh, how could that be? Goodness.
Ha-ha. Well, I'll let you think about that. We'll come back at the end and I'll ask you a question. But that was fascinating.
Maybe was it dirt on your optics?
No. It was a real satellite going in the inverse direction that you would think was normal. Okay, so look, you're interested in the sun. We're all interested in the sun because I alluded to at the beginning, the energy that we use here comes from the sun.
And the sun is so beautiful. It's something that's been in human mythology and in human sort of consciousness forever. I love that aspect of it as well.
When I say that we get all our energy on this Earth, on this planet anyway, from the sun, let's run through, you know, where does it all come from? Because most people think, well, you go outside, you get warm, and that's the energy that the Earth is sort of surviving on. But, of course, there's a large number of different frequencies and therefore wavelengths of energy coming in. Tell us a little bit about the variations within all those different types of radiance.
So the sun is a star. I'm sure that's not a surprise to everyone. It's our nearest star. And like a star, it has a core that burns, basically it's a nuclear burning core that produces energy. And the energy moves by convection to the sun's surface. So that heats the sun's surface. That means the sun, basically, for all intents and purposes, emits light like a black body. So it's a black body at about 6,000 Kelvin. And that means its spectrum, the radiation that it emits, peaks in the visible wavelength. So it's actually an amazing coincidence that the sun, well, it's probably not a coincidence, that the sun's peak energy is at visible wavelengths, which is between about 400 and 700 nanometers. That's the radiation that our eyes are sensitive to. So fortunately for us, the sun's energy comes mainly at visible wavelengths, but it actually emits energy. And by energy, I mean, I'm talking now about radiation, in other words, photons. But it also emits the energy in the form of a wind, particles. But for the Earth's primary energy, then we need to think about the photons. The sun emits photons over a wide range of wavelengths, all the way from X-rays up into the radio spectrum.
And all of that is going to impinge on our planet and transfer energy.
Well, it does. All of it impinges on the planet. And if Earth did not have an atmosphere, then it would receive all of that radiation. But we have an atmosphere that consists primarily of molecular oxygen and nitrogen, but we also have the ozone layer. So ozone is 3 atomic oxygens, so it's O3, whereas molecular oxygen is O2. And between these gases, primarily molecular oxygen and ozone, they absorb essentially all of the sun's radiation in the ultraviolet spectrum and below. So we don't get zapped by X-rays. We don't get zapped by ultraviolet radiation because the atmosphere protects us from that.
Okay, so that tells us what's coming. We've got to take a break here. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm talking to Dr. Judith Lean. who is working at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. in the Space Science Division. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Judith Lean. And Judith, you were just telling us, you know, our atmosphere protects us from some of the less pleasant types of energy, and that is X-rays and high-energy UV. But that energy is still being transferred to the atmosphere because it's being absorbed by the oxygen, the nitrogen, the ozone. So what happens to that energy that's coming in? And then when it hits the atmosphere, you say it filters out from us, but it's still here.
So what happens to that energy is that energy in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, which is not, by the way, the main energy that heats the Earth's surface, of course, because it gets absorbed by the atmosphere. But one thing that the radiation does is actually create the ozone layer, because this energy is sufficiently energetic. Let's say the photons have enough energy to break apart molecular oxygen, which is two oxygen atoms bound together. And that produces oxygen atoms, which then recombine with molecular oxygen to form ozone. So this radiation, this energy goes into the production of ozone, which once it's formed, then absorbs energy at a slightly different wavelength. Then the other thing that the energy does at shorter wavelengths, so if you go down to even shorter wavelengths, below about 100 nanometers, 1,000 angstrom, it heats the upper atmosphere. So the upper atmosphere here is the atmosphere above about 100 kilometers, which is above the ozone layer. So you can think of going from the surface up through the atmosphere, and there's a gradation of the energy deposition depending on the gases. And so by the time you get up to maybe 400 kilometers, which is where the space station is orbiting, the atmosphere there, which is actually the energy of the gases, is hotter than you would expect, and that's because of heating by the sun's energy.
And so in fact, that causes the Earth to be a radiation body also then?
The energy in the ultraviolet and extreme ultraviolet spectrum is pretty small compared to the total energy in the visible. So yes, the Earth radiates as a black body about maybe 250 K, but that's primarily because the visible radiation heats the Earth's surface.
Okay.
Yeah. So that, you're right, though. The layers of the atmosphere do radiate, and very sophisticated instruments on satellites tune to those emissions. They use that as a way to detect the gases.
Okay. So now let's move on to what is the sort of the reason why you are so well known and famous and have been recognized
to be a member. You tell me.
This is what I read, Judith. You're a member of the National Academy of Science.
But you can't believe everything you read on the web, right?
Well, I can believe, I believe that one. You have been involved for your career over the last 10, 20 years on modeling the energy arriving from the sun at the Earth and trying to sort of put that into some topical sort of explanation for global warming, for example. I mean, I've read some of your papers. No, that's not true. I've tried to read some of your papers, and I get the impression from
That's sad. I try to make my papers very user-friendly.
Well, you might well do. The graphs, I understand, but the statements at the bottom of the graphs, I'm not sure that I quite understood.
Okay, I'm going to work on that, I promise.
Okay, lovely. So tell us in a nutshell, what is the conclusion from your modeling, being able to look at the data, to look at global warming, and say what has been the impact of variations on the sun? And, of course, variations in the sunspot cycle, but there are bigger ones. What's the truth to the idea that all global warming at the moment is simply coming from variations of the sun over the period of time?
Oh, goodness, that very long question basically encompasses maybe 20 years of research.
Yes, well, but you've done it, so you can summarize.
Let me start, before I get to your bottom line question, which is how much does the sun's varying radiation affect the climate? Let me go back to a couple of basic things. Like, people think, well, we know that the sun influences the climate because, you know, it's colder at night, it's colder in winter. But those things are cycles related to the Earth's orbit around the sun, like the diurnal cycle and the annual cycle. And when we average over those timescales, like days and years, then what we would like to know is the amount of radiation from the sun actually constant or not? And when I started working in this field in the 1980s, it was pretty much thought to be constant. But it was very exciting because there had been a couple of satellites launched into space, and they began to see variations in the sun's radiation. And when a sunspot would appear on the sun's disk, remember the police group synchronicity?
Yes.
A little black spot on the sun today. So a little black spot on the sun, you can think of it just like a block, or it just blocks a bit of the radiation. So when there are lots of spots on the sun, there's a net decrease in the radiation that emits. But sunspots aren't the only thing on the sun. There are bright regions as well. They're called faculae, and that comes from the Latin word for torch. So on the surface of the sun, and you've probably seen images of the beautiful details of all those sort of regions of brightness distribution on the sun. So there are bright regions and dark regions, and basically they compete to alter the sun's radiation. So the sun has an 11-year cycle, and every 11 years the number of sunspots increases and the number of the bright faculae regions increases, and they compete with each other, and the net effect is that the faculae win over the solar cycle, and there's a change of 0.1% during the solar cycle in the sun's total radiation. Now, everyone thinks, well, 0.1%, you know, so what? But you have to remember the sun gives us so much energy that 0.1% change in the sun's radiation from the maximum to the minimum of the cycle, of the solar cycle. So let's say over 5 years, when the sun's radiation increases by 0.1%, that amount of energy is equivalent to the forcing of the climate system by changing greenhouse gases over that same time period. So that's pretty stunning to think about that. Now, that doesn't mean that the climate responds equally to changes in the sun's radiation and changes in greenhouse gases, because the greenhouse gases have been continuing to increase over the last 150 years. But, of course, the sun has an 11-year cycle, so it goes up and it goes down and it goes up and goes down. So it produces energy that varies, and those variations are considerable, but it cycles. So the question is, can we see these cycles in the Earth's climate? And then the bigger question still is, are there variations in the sun in addition to the solar cycles? So does the sun, the only thing that we've really measured it to do is to have this 11-year cycle, so every 11 years it returns back to a constant value, then it goes up again? But what about in the period called the Maunder Minimum, which is about 400 years ago, which coincided with the Little Ice Age on Earth? Was the sun's radiation lower then? Well, that's where the modelling work that I've done comes into it. And so the bottom line, which is the bottom line of your question, is we can look... Okay, let me give you a little bit of background here. Climate models, physical models of the climate, basically never, ever expected that people would be able to detect an 11-year cycle in the global surface temperature of the Earth due to the sun's changing radiation. And that's because the models basically weren't sophisticated enough to do that. But we have lots of beautiful data now of global temperature on Earth and of the sun's radiation. And what we see is an increase of about 0.1 degree centigrade corresponding to this 0.1% change in the radiation.
So you've been able to tease out then from the records this 11-year cycle associated with our climate.
Yes, and the way
remarkable
that you do that, basically the sun is just one thing influencing the climate. People tend to think, you know, greenhouse gases, they're the things influencing the climate. And sometimes people think they're the only things that are influencing the climate, but things like a volcanic eruption will cool the climate globally. The changes in the sun's cycle will, you know, heat warm and cool. Just it's a very modest amount, 0.1 degree. For comparison, over the last maybe 30 years, the warming by greenhouse gases, which has produced a net increase in the global surface temperature, is about 0.4 degrees centigrade. But then when there's a really big El Nino event, which is a warming in the tropical Pacific, that also affects the global surface temperature record.
Right.
So to pull out all these things, they're all happening together. The El Nino, Southern Oscillation, the volcanic aerosols, although we haven't had many of them recently since 1992, the Pinatubo, and the sun cycle in addition to the greenhouse gases. So you can actually put together a statistical analysis of the observations and pull out all these different components.
And so if we can get, excuse me again, so you think the story's finished now? You think
No, I don't think the story's finished. The reason the story isn't finished is because the physical climate models that are used for projecting into the future, and that, for example, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, uses, aren't very good at reproducing this solar cycle, which means that they're not getting everything right. So the story isn't finished yet for that reason, for one reason, which is the sun provides us with this known changing energy source and we can use it to calibrate the models. But the bigger reason why the story isn't finished yet is we still don't know what the sun, how the sun's radiation might have changed in periods of low activity,
right,
like in the morning minimum, for example. There were no sunspots on the disk for a year at a time. And so some of the work that I've done suggests that maybe the irradiance was a little bit lower during the morning minimum. But, of course, other people like to think that it was maybe even lower, like there was a big reduction in radiation, and then that could have a comparable effect on the climate as we're seeing now from greenhouse gases. I don't believe that's the case. I believe the sun's influence on climate is detectable but modest.
Judith Lean from the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington in the Space Science Division. It's been great talking with you.
Yes, you too, Keith. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Norma Martinez for editing this to make it sound totally professional. And we'll be back again next week with another Science Studio.